Hello, and welcome to episode 70 of the Story Hack Podcast. The Story Hack Podcast features action, adventure, and mystery stories, mostly from the public domain. Story Hack is also a print magazine which publishes new action and adventure stories in a wide variety of genres. Visit storyhack.com today for more information. Today, we will hear part 4 of Wanderers of the Wolf Moon by Nelson S. Bond.
Chapter 4. At that moment, Gregory Malcolm realized what he must do. It was not a pleasant realization. Greg Malcolm was an easygoing, a peaceful, a placid man, the secretarial type. Sparks had called him a stuffed shirt. Never, save in rare moments of dreamful imagining, had Greg ventured to impress his opinions, his will, upon the desires of fellow men. But he, of all those now surrounding him, seemed to understand, fully and completely, the crisis which now faced their refugee group. And he, it was made apparent to him by the pompousness of Foster Andrews, by the mulish petulance of Bert Andrews, by the aloof hauteur of Crystal and Mrs. Andrews, by the suicidal orders just given by Ralph Bredon. He alone was, in this moment of need, capable of deciding the destinies of the Earth exiles. J. Foster Andrews had the acumen and common sense to lead them, but he had not the requisite knowledge. Yep. Bredon had the training, the space experience, but he lacked solid horse sense, and his decisions were too strongly flavored by his own savor of self-importance. Yet if they, 10 humans, were to exist for a week, a month, a year, until help reached them, someone must command. And he, Gregory Malcolm, was the only one capable of taking into his hands the reins of rulership. It was a knowledge at once heady, intoxicating, and frightening. But there it was. It had to be faced. And Greg moved, grimly but methodically, to the accomplishment of that which he deemed necessary. He halted the radio man with a gesture. "Wait a minute, Sparks. Tommy, wait. Tina." And he faced Bredon firmly. "We are not going to do that, Mr. Bredon," he said. "It would not be wise. We are not going to do it." Bredon's brown features darkened with swift anger. What's this? And Jay. Foster Andrews waddled forward, puffing irate astonishment. Here, Malcolm, what do you mean? This is H.R. Rumpf. Blasted impertinence, sir, insubordination. Malcolm held his ground, his pale cheeks oddly flushed. "We are not going to do these things," he repeated slowly, definitely. Bredon. It did not occur to him that unconsciously he had abandoned the respectful, formal Mr. which heretofore he had never omitted. "Bredon, your orders clearly indicate that you have not in any way grasped the full implications of our plight. I have already warned that we should not make needless use of our limited fuel and power reserves. Yet you've told Tommy to bring the electro stove. I have hinted that there are dangerous antagonists on Titan. Yet you wish boldly to tempt attack by cooking and eating here on this exposed plain in broad daylight. Common sense should advise you of the folly of eating what few food stores we hold in reserve. Yet you calmly command the preparation of a full and wasteful meal." He did not make mention of the other, perhaps irrelevant but nonetheless rankling detail, that never once had Bredon offered to help in these doings, nor had any member of the Andrews clan volunteered to assist, that the physical labor had arbitrarily been assigned to those of lesser caste, himself, Hannigan, young Tommy, Tina. "Therefore," he continued doggedly, "I, for one, am refusing to obey your orders. I do so because I must. Call it insubordination, if you wish." Andrews, the older man, spluttered incoherently, mauve-jowled. "But I would call it the will to exist, the law of survival. I mean to survive on this unknown, hostile planet. That can't be done if we squander resources as Bredon apparently means to." A moment of tight silence answered his outburst. A slow, awkward movement stirred through the little group. It was, Greg sensed, a movement of alignment. He could sense, rather than see, the unconscious coalition of his sympathizers behind him. Could see without sensing the outraged drawing together of the Andrews husband and wife, Phil and Phils, beside Bredon. One there was whose bright, intent eyes were clouded with uncertainty, Maud Andrews. Then, as if irresistibly drawn by the bonds of blood, she too looked to Bredon as her spokesman. Bredon's voice was a thick flame of wrath. "So that's the way it is, eh, Malcolm? Well, this had to come sooner or later. Might as well have it over with right now. Get the glasses off, my pale young friend. One leader is all we'll have around here." He stepped forward, bigger, browner, heavier than Malcolm. There was a rustle behind Greg. Sparks had stepped to his side, was pressing something into his hand. "This'll make him behave, Greg. Put it away," said Greg coldly. "We'll have better use for firearms later on. I'll handle this the way Bredon wants." Slowly, painstakingly, he removed his plaster-rimmed glasses, slipped them in a lucite case, slid the case into a pocket, removed his trimly cut double-breasted business coat, handed it to the grumbling little redhead. "But look," growled Sparks, then stopped. There was a newness about Greg Malcolm that stopped him. With the goggles removed, he thought dimly, Malcolm's eyes looked different, less soft and meeky-mosey. They were like sort of like chunks of gray flint. And Greg wasn't as skinny as he had looked, now that you saw him with his coat off. He was lean, yes, but there was a greyhound whippiness to his leanness, a tight, spring-coiled sort of strength. "Well," said Greg, "you're ready, Bredon." Bredon's answer was a sudden, rushing charge. One of the women gasped. There came the whipping splat of flesh striking flesh, then all noises muted save the sound of two men meeting in face-to-face conflict. Bredon's left jarred Greg back. His right swung wide and hard to put a swift end to the dispute, but found no target. For leanly, deftly, with panther-like swiftness, Greg was out from under the blow, his own left probing sharply, flicked once, twice. Again into his antagonist's face, jarring Bredon, shocking, stunning him, halting his bull-like rush and jolting him back on his heels. Maddened, Bredon whirled, seeking this will-o'-the-wisp whose jabbing left stung like salt in an open wound. He growled something that was never completed, for Knuckles bruised the word against his lips. Blood sprang, saline and hot, in his mouth. The taste of it edged his rage to inchoate blindness. He flailed out recklessly, forgetful of anything he had previously known about fighting. And that was his undoing. Against his bulky charge, Greg could do nothing but fight the kind of fleeting defensive battle he had learned in long hours at the gymnasium. A maddened warrior like this was a different matter, though. He was a vulnerable fighter. Calmly and with infinite assurance, Greg stepped inside Bredon's swinging arms beneath his faulty guard. His right hand came up once sharply to Bredon's jaw. The big man spluttered pink spray, lifted his arms. Again Greg lashed out with his left, this time to the belly. Bredon gasped and his mouth remained open, sagging. Like the whipping length of a python, Malcolm threw that lean, deadly sure right again, this time squarely to the other man's jaw at the spot where jawbone meets the ear. The blow cracked in the dull, astonished silence like the chunk of a heart-biting axe on timber. Bredon straightened slowly, numbly, in a meaningless reflex. The fire went out of his eyes, their brownness dulled like sun-faded velvet. Then he fell, as a tall building might fall, crumpling. The knees folding first, the body sagging, the shoulders, the head helpless and rolling. In sections. He rolled once and lay still. Sparks Hannigan said, "God almighty." His voice was feeble, awestruck. Greg Malcolm's fists falling to his sides, uncoiled reluctantly. As if they had gripped the fiery baton of his anger, the battle urge slipped from him with their unclenching. He drew a deep breath to steady his ragged breathing, nodded to the wide-eyed Tina. "Take care of him," he said. "Water. He'll be all right in a minute." He faced the others, his manner an odd mixture of apology and aggressiveness. "Bredon said there could be but one in command," he said. "Let us hope that is definitely settled, for all time, and now I will ask all of you to help. Our first step will be to strip the skiff of the equipment we may need and carry it into the hills. In one of those caves, we will make our headquarters." But the fight was to have its aftermath. Crystal Andrews it was who burst from the little knot before him to kneel at her fiancé's side, taking Bredon's head in her arms, glaring rage and hot defiance at Greg. "With you," she cried. "With you, you cheap upstart bully. Not in a million years. Ralph, Ralph, dear, are you all right? Did he hurt you?" She jerked the water-soaked handkerchief from the maid's hands, pressed its coolness to Bredon's sand-bruised forehead. Bredon's eyes opened, dazed at first, then full of awareness, sultry, indignant, incredulous. He moved to get on his feet again. Greg stared at him coldly. "Get up if you want to, Bredon, but don't get up fighting." Hannigan chuckled. "He ain't hurt much, just his conceit. It's punched full of right and left hand wallops." "That will do, Sparks," snapped Greg. He looked at the others, replacing his glasses carefully, a vague sorrow in his eyes, defeat in his voice despite his victory. "You all feel that way, you still refuse." Crystal Andrews cried out, "Talk, talk. Will you stop talking and go? Go to the hills if you want to. Leave us in peace. We don't want you and don't need you. Go to the hills and good riddance to you." The tiny gimlet of hurt that lay somewhere deep inside of Greg twisted once more at her words, snapped, became suddenly cold and bitter. His jaw set. He nodded to Sparks. "Very well, if that's your desire, Sparks, there are four of us, six of them. Take an inventory of all equipment and supplies in the skiff. We will take exactly 4/10 of everything. Fuel, power units, food, water, everything. Get going. I'll help you directly." Sparks said, "The radio. We'll take that. You're the only one capable of repairing it. We'll save them in spite of themselves, if we can." Sparks said, "Aye, sir. Come on, Tommy, Tina." He started toward the crashed skiff. Greg hesitated, feeling the desire to say something, to make one final plea, not knowing what to say or how to say it, restrained by the yet cold anger etched on his heart by Crystal's scorn. Then he too turned to help. A strident voice halted him. "Just a moment, young man." "Yes, Miss Andrews." Maud Andrews, cuddles firmly cradled to her ample bosom, left her brother's side and marched toward the life skiff. "Tell Sparks to make that a 50-50 division," she said. "There will be five of us in the hills." Enid Andrews bleated faintly. Crystal, still kneeling, stared at her aunt incredulously. "Jay." Foster Andrews vented his indignation in a sudden, blustering roar. "Maud, don't be a blasted idiot. Come back here this minute." Maud Andrews continued to surge inexorably forward. "I'm not," she grunted, "being an idiot. It's you who are my dear, fat, dim-witted brother. I'm a selfish, pampered old fool, but I know common sense when I hear it, and I know a man when I see one. Furthermore, silly as you may think it, I have a ridiculous desire to keep on living. I may have to work to do that, and I'm not overly fond of work, but if Mr. Malcolm will have me." "Just plain Malcolm, Miss Andrews," said Greg gravely, gratefully, "and I'm happy you see it my way." "Tut, I'm not doing you a favor, Malcolm. I'm just looking out for myself, as I always do. Well, Sparks, don't stand there yawping like my thick, pateated brother. What can I do to help?" She waddled away. Greg glanced hopefully at those still waiting, immobile. "Won't you," he began, "won't the rest of you?" The eyes that met his were glacial. Bert Andrews, thick-lipped and bridling, snarled disdain. "The hell with you, Malcolm. The sooner you get out of here, the better." Greg said, "We'll let you know where to find us. If you should need us, just call." "We won't need you." That was Crystal, coldly. "I hope you won't," said Greg. "I sincerely hope you won't."
This is the end of episode 70. Thank you for listening. If you want to support the podcast, please visit storyhack.com and check out issues of the magazine or our other anthology publications. You'll be glad you did.